From the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Notstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax, but buckle up, and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to another edition of Civitalk. The orange phone on Fayetteville Street, Brooke and I will discuss that. The foam meets fashion. I don't know if it's a controversy or just a really positive thing, but we'll talk shoe fashion just briefly. And of course, we'll jump into the Democrat debate and homeschooling and school choice in North Carolina. So I'm happy to be here, Brooke. How's it going?
It is going splendid. Good. Wonderful. I'm having a great day.
So you pointed this out to me first. It was the orange phone. It's a project of Elevation Church. Anybody in the Raleigh area knows what Elevation Church is. They have campuses, I think.
They're based out of Charlotte.
Yeah, they're right. Is it the Summit in Charlotte?
No, it's Elevation Church with Pastor Stephen Furtick.
Okay.
So he's a mega pastor in Charlotte.
Okay. I knew that they were based out of Charlotte and they had a Raleigh campus. And they have several campuses in Raleigh and Charlotte. They probably have more.
Yeah.
I just don't know about them. And they may have in other urban areas or even rural areas in the state. But they have a project, and they have a phone that they set up on Fayetteville Street. You can also call the number. I will give out the number. I don't think they would mind. It's in the news. So 833-536-LOVE. If you need positive encouragement, you can call this number. They'll tell you things like you're thebomb.com. They'll say there's no one like you. There needs to be more people like you. And they just give you general positivity. So this is a church project, Brooke. Did you have any thoughts on this? Or just is this a good thing? Do people need this?
Okay, people need encouragement.
That's true.
That is the truth. But Ray and I both called the number, and I have a healthy and really appreciative stance towards those that actually spend time trying to encourage other people. Did this hit that spot for me personally as I called the number? Not so much.
Really?
It seemed like a little bit of just platitudes and insincerity. You are so amazing. You are thebomb.com. There is no one like you. And that just was so generic to me. But I like the idea of it. And I think what they're trying to do is there are a lot of people that struggle with self-worth. And so the intention there, I think, is really, really good. But if somebody wants to motivate me, I think they're going to have to give me a little bit more sincere encouragement and maybe some candy.
Yeah, it's hard to criticize because they're doing a good thing, right? So it's hard to just kind of sit from where we are actually doing nothing or setting up nothing in comparison and just criticize them. I mean, I don't want people calling me at all hours of the days, even though it's obviously a taped call, but I like encouraging people too, but I don't want people calling me at 3 o'clock in the morning that need encouragement. But so it's hard to criticize it in a way, but to me it came across as a little bit cheesy. And being a church, I know Elevation Church is sometimes teased by some Christian communities in the Triangle or just in the state, and some just mega church culture in general can be made fun of, but there was one in Memphis and at Ole Miss we used to call Six Flags Over Jesus. I think it was Bellevue Baptist Church. Uh-huh. I know you've heard that before, but I wouldn't mind if they had a little bit more constructive criticism or something. I might call if you had some constructive criticism to give somebody and tell them, get this out of your lifestyle and
get your act together.
Yeah, I think I would respond better if a drill sergeant recording or something.
Okay, and so
they probably have that somewhere.
Yes, different people respond differently. I mean, some people need that sort of encouragement because they're so kind of down on themselves anyways that I think they need someone to pull them up. And then there's other people who tend to be a little bit more, they excuse their own bad behavior a little bit quicker, and so they need someone to whip them into shape.
Yeah.
Which is why many men get married, I think. They just don't realize that's why they're doing it.
Getting back to what I was probably trying to say, being a church, and obviously Elevation has a, principles and a confession of faith on their website. I wonder if there was a little bit more, and I don't think it has to be overtly Christian, but if there was a little bit more of a sort of faith-oriented direction they could give in sort of their encouragement, maybe throwing in a passage or throwing in something that just, I think, reflects who you are as a child of God to some degree, instead of just sort of bland platitudes. That may give people a little bit more of a boost than sort of the bland platitude. But of course, like you said, everybody responds differently. And this is a safe way maybe to introduce people.
Yeah, it's an introduction to that, perhaps. I don't know.
A program that's tied to a church, and it's a positive story. So I'm not going to just diss it for the sake of dissing it. So to speak.
You are, Ray. You're totally dissing it. Totally. We're so judging you for it right now.
I do want to say something. And I know we probably have a listener out there who attends Elevation Church, but you know, I do remember when first moving to Raleigh and someone talking about Elevation Church, and she's like, I never grew up in the church. And I'm not criticizing this, because if this is where she goes to church, I think that's a good thing. But she remembers, she goes like, to me, it's just like entertainment, you know? She kind of said, like, it's a rock
She
concert.
Just maybe didn't know the right
correct
terms.
Phrasing or something.
Yeah, I mean, I go to a very, very large church as well. And I think churches are much the way that we should look at shoes, which we're about to talk about. There are different styles for different people.
Yeah,
and
no
that's
doubt.
Our segue into Flow First.
There's no doubt. No. And of course, you know, if you have a different style of church, then that you got to find, I think.
As long as it stays true.
Don't be necessarily be a consumer where you go out and church shop, but you got to find something that fits you to a degree and then that you're comfortable with. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's but call that number. If you need encouragement, I would just kind of just try it out. Maybe it'll change the trajectory of your day. It's possible. You never know.
You can email Ray, radio
so
at NC
before we get into the serious stuff, Brooke, let's address the flofers.
Flofers in the room.
Because my wife Kelly wanted us to talk about this on the podcast, and she was obviously making fun of it. I do remember Crocs when that kind of surged to popularity. I was actually in seminary, and I remember there was a student at our school who got the Crocs, and you could spot him from across campus because he had these orange Crocs, and they were just everywhere. You know,
they're everywhere. Yeah, all right. They're actually seeing a resurgence among high schoolers. My daughter asked for Crocs for Christmas.
Interesting.
And a number of her friends wear them. So they like roll up their skinny jeans, wear their Croc slides, and then like some funky socks.
So they're like cool now.
They're like cool, which is strange, right?
Yeah.
Yes. So anyways, I know people in the medical profession wear them. They're on their feet all day long. But I will stick with my cute. I've got cheetah print heels on right now, so I'm going to stick with those. But what are you wearing?
I'm wearing Oxford-type dress shoes.
Okay. You're not wearing your cowboy boots.
No, but I do like – probably that's my favorite, but sometimes all day wearing them is not always easy.
Yeah. You're telling me. I understand.
So I sympathize with the women out there because wearing the – even though these cowboy boots are pretty comfortable, if you wear them all day, sometimes they can get a little tiring.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So I sympathize with the women out there.
You know what? So speaking of this, and I know we need to move on and maybe cover the flofers real quick, but I want to say that I think the government should have some sort of, you know how there's handicap stickers for people who have a medical requirement? I feel like those ladies who were wearing maybe 3.5-inch heels or higher, we should have like a special sticker when we're parking downtown Raleigh. Because I was in downtown Raleigh for lunch this afternoon for an appointment, and I had a very hard time finding parking. And then there's like a safety risk because I'm wearing these heels and they might get stuck in the grates on the sidewalk and I could hurt my ankle.
As somebody who is kind of old-fashioned and, you know, part of the patriarchy, I'd be okay with that.
You would?
Yeah, I would. See? I'm all for putting women first.
Thank you.
As long as men get sort of their, you know, their cut and what's due them, then I will
as long as they get their
women
cut.
First.
That's funny. Yeah. Okay, yeah, but the flofers are kind of funky. You guys can check them out online, but it's where foam meets fashion, and to me, foam and fashion don't really go together.
Yeah, and just quickly, I think... not to go off on a tangent, but you know how you see like old movies or you just see pictures from the olden days, pre 19, late 60s. Fashion was a lot better in many ways. Men dressed up to go to the ball game, men dressed up to go out, same as women, obviously. Clothes was more expensive, so there was a negative. I mean, I think Brian Balfour wrote about that recently, about how clothes are becoming less and less of a chunk of a human's budget.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, back in the day, they may have been like 20%. Now it's much, much less than that.
Yeah.
And because of, you know, obviously trade, when Trump's not trying to muck it up, free trade has been a big positive for that. And also just, you know, people get away with wearing sloppier things.
They do. That's true. I mean, like clothes aren't custom fit anymore unless you really are willing to shell out a lot of money for that. And that's not an easy thing to do. And so it can be quite the pain just to find clothes that fit you exactly how you want that look like good quality. So
what was the best era of fashion just to just in the 20th century? Let's stick to like now to the 20th and this 21st century. What was the best decade of fashion?
I like... When was White Christmas?
For women. Because men hasn't changed dramatically.
No. White Christmas, when was that based out of?
I think the 1940s.
I would say that then, because I love
50s are pretty good, too, I would say. For women, 50s are like the top.
Yeah, I like the 50s, too. I like those skirts. I like high-waisted things, so I think that that's cute. They've got the skirts. 1954 is when White Christmas was released.
Okay, so 50, we're in agreement.
Yeah, I like that era. So
yeah, for sure.
Clothing
I would say
actually
that
fit
that's,
like it should.
No, and then the early 60s too. That era seems just very classic to me and is a good look.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, I would like to talk
I'm
about
such
fashion
a fashion
for
expert.
Quite,
like,
yes,
we could
you
talk
are,
about
Ray. You are.
But just, you're probably not big into 80s fashion.
Ew.
The big shoulder pads
ew,
and big hair.
No, and then the funky eyeshadow. Yeah, it was
there was
all the geometric shapes. I didn't like that.
And those wide ties on men, a lot of them like brown. And
yeah, and then like the big baggy pants, even on women. I don't know.
I had parachute pants in kindergarten.
So did I. I had hammer pants.
Did
my
you?
Mom
okay,
bought me
that's really embarrassing. Parachute pants are way better than hammer pants.
Mom, why did you let me wear those?
Also, mine was kindergarten. It sounded like you were wearing hammer pants in high school.
I was wearing them in kindergarten, Ray.
Okay.
If you had listened, you would have heard that. So, hey, did you watch the Dim Debate?
No, I
two
got
two Dim Debates.
I actually like was reading a book or something.
Oh,
doing something more.
Wise man.
I'm going to wait until I think this field winnows or narrows a little bit.
Right. Well, you know, only seven people
watch
seven
the debate. I believe it.
Only seven candidates currently qualify for the next round
oh, really?
Of debates at the end of August. So that's interesting. I think they have to. They have to have 130,000 unique donors and have to have like 2% of the vote in the four top polls or
ooh,
four different
wow.
polls. So the
poll
ante
100%.
Is a lot higher.
So let me ask you something before we kind of cover the debate in general, just because Kelly and I went to a Durham Bulls game and we sat behind somebody who had is his name Andrew Yang?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yang Gang.
Yeah, he had a Yang 2020 hat on and Kelly didn't know who Yang was, which, you know, most people don't. And so she kind of said, well, Yang 2020. And he immediately turned around and went into a monologue. He's like, I was telling you about Yang and
Yang
what
bots.
I knew about him. And then he goes, may I interrupt you and expand upon what you've said? So, you know, just give me kind of a rundown. Because I see a lot of my conservative friends on Twitter who are all in on Yang. Some of them libertarian, some of them conservative. Some of them who are big Trump supporters. So he's drawing, I guess, from the left, the right, and obviously the middle. So, you know, he's just... I don't know if he'll explode into there's Yang memes all over the internet, but I don't know if he'll explode into this next pack. But just tell me something about him because I see him drawing from a cross-sectional group of Americans.
Mm-hmm. So he doesn't sound like exceptionally crazy, which or very very far left. So I think that's where he's winning some moderates because the way that he presents the information, he talks about his family a lot, but not in a way that seems like disingenuous or nauseating. And he seems sincere. He's an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And his message is very very simple, clear. Although when I was on the show with Tyler Crowley this morning of 980 Wave over in Wilmington, he was saying that if you really read into what Yang, his policy platform is, he's a lot more nuanced, but he really talks about the universal basic income, which is called UBI.
Mm-hmm.
And
Charles Murray, who's a big libertarian, is a proponent.
Oh, Charles Murray is
I
too?
I think so, yeah.
I know, you said Milton Friedman was.
Friedman at one, I mean, I don't know throughout his whole life, but yeah, he supported that.
So that's a very libertarian concept in some quarters.
Some circles,
Not broadly speaking. But anyway, so Yang is saying, look, why don't we just give everybody $1,000 guaranteed income each month? And that would solve a lot of these issues that we have, whether it's unemployment, recidivism in the judicial system and things like that. So that's his main platform. But you and I were both a little skeptical of the universal basic income.
I'm not an expert on it. I've studied a little bit. Victor Davis Hanson, who is a scholar at the Hoover Institution, has written some about it, and he's tracked it in California because he's really, I mean, he's an expert on a lot of things, but he's an expert on California mostly. And he writes a lot about California, how the failed liberal policies out there have really wrecked the state. And there's been some municipalities and I think some counties in California that have experimented with universal basic income. And from his assessment, it's been a disaster. And a lot of them have moved away from that. And some of the European countries, I think, are considering that, do have it. And some of the Scandinavian countries are considering moving away from it now because it's just not worked out like mm-hmm. they thought it would.
It sounds good in theory, I'd say, if you're talking about removing all the other entitlement programs and just replacing it.
Well,
with
yeah, we'd probably
like
save
that.
Money at that point if we're removing all these entitlement programs.
But the thing is, when does government ever actually really shrink? You know, so yeah. You can talk about implementing a UBI and exchanging it for entitlement programs, but I have yet to see government effectively roll back any meaningfully. Right. Roll back any entitlement program.
I think that's the thing with just shifting real quick to tax policy. A lot of people want to get rid of the income tax and place it with a consumption tax, which I think would be a great idea mm-hmm. if we had a consumption tax. But then they say, well, you know, we can add this tax and get rid of the income tax, but, you know, that's never going to happen. I think most people will kind of look at it and say, well, we could say we're going to do this, but we're going to end up like Europe, where you have a value added tax or a VAT tax over there. And so that's like the big thing, like Brooke said, is like, how do you ever get rid of these programs? I mean, Ronald Reagan said there's nothing more permanent than a temporary government program. And I think that's a big problem because, right, I mean, it's just adding another entitlement on top of entitlements when we're $23 trillion in debt. And, you know, I just don't ever see... Unfortunately, I don't see any sort of meaningful entitlement reform coming in the near future.
Yeah, but let's talk about some of the other big players. So Joe Biden continues to dominate the polls, even though he did not have a strong showing last night. So I watched both nights of debates. This was Joe Biden's second debate because he debated mm-hmm. last month as well. And I was not that impressed with how his response time he looked. And he always acted as if he was very, very eager to finish his sentence or to finish talking as soon mm-hmm. as the time was up. So he would stop mid-sentence and wouldn't complete his thoughts. And so it just seemed like he was just itching to get off that stage. Nonetheless, he did not do as bad as he did the previous debate. And so as long as he can kind of float rather than swim or sink, I think he's going to probably, he looks like he's going to be the nomination. I mean, it's still really early, but.
Yeah, it's so early, so it's hard to say. I know the betting, the early betting on some of those sites, those trend sites, was putting it on Kamala Harris, but I'm skeptical of her getting the nomination.
She didn't shine last night, yeah. That's for sure. Tulsi Gabbard went after her.
But Biden, to me, is the clear favorite, and he's going to remain the clear favorite as long as the field's kind of big, and I think mm-hmm. it's going to be somewhat big for a while. So, you know, until there starts being some actual votes counted, I'm going to believe Biden is the favorite because, look, I mean, so many of these people in the Democratic Party are going so far left, and Biden is kind of going along with them to some degree, but he's not going full bore all in, and he realizes, you know, he's been part of national campaigns before, so I think he realizes that he has to taper some of that rhetoric to some degree. And, you know, if I had to pick somebody out of the big field, I'm not talking about Yang or Tulsi Gabbard or other people who are maybe more minor characters, but if I had to pick somebody out of that big field that would be somewhat palpable to some degree, it would be Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm. Compared to Warren yeah. and Sanders,
yeah, who are
which
just
are the
so
other front runners.
Far left and Booker. And
yeah, they're all about just eradicating private options in healthcare, which yep. is really a scary, scary thought. So yeah. they're talking about an entire industry, the leading issue among most Americans, sometimes second to immigration, but oftentimes even before immigration. And they're talking about making it completely public and removing any sort of private competition. That's scary.
It's completely scary because if you went to a single payer system, could you imagine? I mean, if you're relatively healthy and you never go to the doctor, yeah, you'd be annoyed that you'd be losing 17-20% of your paycheck or whatever they decide to take for their universal medicine.
Yeah.
But you know, could you imagine like having to have your care rationed or waiting in such long lines or waiting 6 months longer possibly to see a specialist?
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine the reduction in innovation we would have in the nation
gosh.
As a result?
Yeah.
Because that we've taken away the incentives to encourage people to think innovatively and to I guess test certain technologies in a way that they would likely not be incentivized to do so.
Absolutely.
Under a smaller pay
yeah.
scale.
After college, my first job, I worked for Congressman Gene Taylor, conservative Democrat in South Mississippi, and I did VA casework. I helped out a guy doing VA casework, and then I ended up taking it over when he got sick for a short time before I went to seminary. And gosh, talk about a disaster, the VA system. I mean, there, you know, there's a positive for maybe like 10% of the people in the system that they
it works
just,
for
yeah,
some.
It works for some. And then there's another huge group or clump that it's just a disaster, you know, waiting 6, 7, 8 months to see a doctor, sometimes over a year just to see a doctor. And, you know, then they go and then, you know, they'd get a procedure done and they need another procedure and they're waiting another year.
Well, like, for example, my uncle was, he had diabetes and he had to wait a long time to get seen by the VA. It finally got so bad that they were going to remove his foot. They had to take it off and amputate. And he was already battling depression at that point in time. And I'm not blaming the VA for this, but I'm just saying the dire straits that some of these former service members are in, and a lot of them are alone and don't have family support system. He ended up taking his own life.
Yeah.
You know, there's just a
lot. It's not that uncommon because of the lack of care. And I mean, I have a proposal that I think people should think about before we go into a universal single payer system. Why not fix the VA system? If the government can prove that they can fix the VA system, then maybe have a talk about single payer. But how do you not fix that system
and then
go around and say, hey, we're going to do this?
Right. Well, and Kamala Harris was saying this yesterday. Babies are going to even be born into this healthcare system that I'm creating that is going to eliminate any sort of private option. That's not comforting as a person, as a parent and eventual grandparent one day. Like, telling me that my children are going to be born into that sort of system and I look over to my left at the VA that my husband is going to be now getting care from as a veteran, that's not very comforting.
Yeah, and then at what point does the government, it won't take long because they're going to be in the cross-control measure, what point do they say, we're going to make a decision about whether this is viable treatment for you, whether this is viable for you to have this baby, because we're going to be shouldering the expense. Single payer means single decision. So
it's a good way to say it, and just, very sobering. So that was something that I thought that was a big alarm bell and takeaway from the debates these past couple of nights, is that there was this huge attempt to normalize single-payer health care in a way that I had not previously seen. So
yeah, I mean, it sounds good in theory. You know, free government should... And we do have a healthcare crisis in this country. We have to control costs. There are things that need to be done to address costs. But 90% of people have healthcare in this nation. We forget that to some degree. And I think it's important that we find a way to bring down costs to open up access. And I know that those aren't easy things, because if it was just an easy part of markets solving every aspect of the healthcare problem, then we probably would find a way to do that. But I mean, from jumping from the problems we have now instead of trying to solve some of the problems we have in our system now to a single payer system makes no sense to me.
Not at all. Not at all. Government interference into these sort of things, I have yet to actually see it be very effective, whether it's the student loan market, the housing market, or the healthcare market.
We should do a podcast on where government, because there are examples, but where there has been lots of government intervention for a positive. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, Bob and I were talking about that yesterday, and we talked about how safe airline industry. I don't know how much of this is on the government. I think some is, and then some is on some of those private companies. Even though air travel, to me, is horrible, at least from an experience. From a safety level, it's one of the most safest things you can ever do. I mean, there hasn't, I don't think there's been a full commercial crash. I know there's been deaths through incidents and things, but there hasn't been a full commercial crash in the U.S. since 2014.
Okay, wow.
So that's pretty impressive considering, you know, you used to have multiple crashes annually not too long ago.
Whew.
So knock on wood,
that would be interesting tomorrow.
But
yeah, that'd be interesting to talk about, because government does serve a purpose. It does have a place. We're not anti-government. We're anti-government intrusion into things that it doesn't, its nose doesn't belong in. So anyways, let's finish up this episode talking about the rise of the homeschoolers. The rise
like
of the
movie.
Denim jumpers.
The rise of the homeschoolers. Well, I'm going to let Brooke take it away from here, because she is the expert. I have a few stats because I've been writing about this today, but Brooke is truly the expert on homeschooling. So why don't you just give us some thoughts? I'm interested in why North Carolina is so much higher than the other states. I think there's some reasons I've been thinking about, but North Carolina is considerably higher than any other state when it comes to percentage of homeschoolers.
Yeah. So when I homeschooled my children for 8 years, and then my parents took over and they homeschooled for an additional year. And I actually graduated as a homeschooler. So halfway through my ninth grade year, all the way till senior year, I homeschooled. My mom was even a homeschooler back in the day before it was technically even legal.
Do you have a diploma?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I have an accredited diploma.
Oh, it's not filled out with crayon or anything? Did you fill it out and sign it?
There we go with my left hand, try to forge a signature.
Just teasing. Most homeschoolers are like a lot smarter than I am, so I'm always
no,
like
No, actually, and then I ended up going to Campbell University before I transferred to the college that I graduated from. But yeah, so I preface all that and say it like that because homeschooling is something that's near and dear to my heart. I care a lot about that community. I think there are some amazing people within it. It is a subculture within the U.S., but nonetheless, people choose different reasons for homeschooling. Mm-hmm. However, what Ray and I were wanting to really hone in on was the rise in North Carolina. We are there are twice as many homeschoolers in North Carolina than there are the second state that comes behind us in that list, which is Arkansas. So we 7.7% of our population homeschools. Nationally, though, I think only like 2% of the population.
Yeah, Arkansas is 3.7% of the K-12 population are homeschooled.
Okay. So we're a solid 4 points ahead of them on
Isn't
that.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there's a number of reasons. One would be we have very favorable homeschool laws in North Carolina. Mm-hmm.
It's easy to homeschool here.
And another one I think is, this is true to other states too, but Common Core is completely unpopular. Yeah. So I think that has created a surge of homeschooling. And then North Carolina too is a pretty rural state. So I think that creates opportunities for homeschooling that other states may not have in terms of, you know, if you just live in a rural area and you have one access to a school and that school stinks, you mm-hmm. definitely may consider homeschooling more. And then, you know, obviously we're a fairly religious state.
Bible beltish, right?
Yeah, somewhat Bible beltish compared to the rest of the country. Although I think there's a lot of secularization in North Carolina too through rapid urbanization. But I would say overall, North mm-hmm. Carolina tends to be more Christian than a lot of other states.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even in the urban areas, so in the Raleigh Triangle area, there's a huge thriving homeschool population, despite the fact that we have a lot of education mm. options. But we also, homeschooling here has been a delight because there are so many resources. There are so many outside classes you can take your children to, so many communities and groups. And so it's great because you can tailor your child's education to their specific needs. And so even if they do have special learning needs or you just want to spend more time with your kids, for us, as my husband was deployed and he had to go away a lot for TDY trips, it was nice to be able to tailor our school schedule to work around his work schedule so we could spend more time with him, too.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. I used to make fun of homeschooling kind of when I was in high school and stuff. But as I've gotten older, it makes a lot of sense to me in the sense that sitting in, especially if you have boys, and, you know, I have two boys, and sitting in a classroom all day sort of just facing the front of the class and doing the same thing that everybody else is doing may not make sense for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it just makes a lot of sense from that standpoint in terms of tailoring a curriculum for an individual. And, you know, there's a lot of good public schools in our state, obviously, but I think that model is dead. You know,
that kind of utilitarian,
not for everybody, but yeah, that factory model, utilitarian. I don't see why that would be the best option available for probably most people out there. You mm-hmm. know, I may be controversial to say that now, but it just seems like
a
model.
I think a lot of teachers share that frustration.
Yeah, I think
too,
it's just
though.
A model that's just kind of stale to me. I mean, we're using this kind of model, I think, when our society was much more homogenous, much more culturally homogenous, obviously much more sort of maybe even white and just sort of homogenous to some degree, where this sort of model worked for most communities. And I just don't see it that way anymore, where that model would work for most people.
Well, and it's kind of interesting because I've read up a little bit on this, the current education model that we have, which was largely shaped by John Dewey at the beginning of the 20th century. And it had a lot to do with dealing with the high immigrant influx. So people were coming into the U.S., didn't know how to speak English. And so they created this sort of one size fits all education. Before that, oftentimes education was handled at a very, very local level. And, you know, families were a lot more involved in the process. And, you know, just everybody was, it was communal. And this took on that factory model. And that isn't something that a lot of kids are able to thrive in. But when you have so much central planning, so much bureaucracy involved in education, you really can't help but implement it in such a way unless you're willing to relinquish control. And so that's why here at Civitas, we really care greatly about school choice and about decentralizing a lot of education, allowing it to be handled, even public education, at the most local level possible. And that's, I think, where we're able to set up our children to really thrive.
I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, a lot of it just comes back to parents thinking deeply when you have kids and the kids are entering the world and they're getting close to an age where schooling is appropriate. It's just really thinking about the purpose of education and what you want to accomplish for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. And so I think if you're sort of outsourcing to a public school, well, that's the easiest. And I'm not criticizing people who do that because there's a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of great public schools, and it's maybe something my wife and I do. I don't know yet. And, you know, I just think that, I think if you're asking those deeper questions about what the purpose of education is, and if you're a Christian or you're somebody who's of a different faith, you certainly want to incorporate that into the educational process, in my opinion. It doesn't mean you always do it through public school, but I think just learning and education in general is a good way to incorporate some of those values and beliefs into the lifestyle of your family and children. And that's a good route to go, whether it be through just something alternative to public education. And so to me, I think the model's just kind of broken to some degree. I mean, you see, you know, we focus sometimes on the bad examples where you may have, you know, these trans groups coming in and reading to your kids. I know when I was in Hawaii in seventh grade, Planned Parenthood came into our classroom, very liberal public schools out there. And I was just kind of shocked and appalled, even though I didn't know a lot about Planned Parenthood in seventh grade, or nor did I know a lot about some of the sexual stuff they were talking about. They were teaching things that I was just like, I don't think this is right for, for our age group.
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not very easy to opt out of some of those things. So if the administrator or superintendent of a school district wants things to go a certain direction, then that's oftentimes how they have to go. And so that's where parents really appreciate homeschooling if you're a homeschool family, and I think that's North Carolina's high homeschool numbers speak to that desire for some autonomy. But anyways, we're about out of time. It was a wonderful episode. Nice talking about Flofers.
Yeah,
homeschooling.
I heard they have them at Belk, so if I go there, I may try them on.
Yes, take back a photo, put them on Instagram.
Oh yeah, I'll get some likes and stuff. So sure, certainly, if you want to be a sponsor, Flofers, we'll still take you as a sponsor. So,
yeah.
We could change our opinions very quickly for a check.
At the right price, yeah. We too can promote foam and fashion.
Yeah, so check out all our content, nccivitas.org. We got a lot of new content, and we're pumping it out daily, just about, really daily. And so go to our site, check out what we're writing about it. We appreciate you, and hope you all have a great week.
Thank you, guys.